You are listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
Hello, and welcome to Create Here and our interview today with visiting artist Megan Gould. I'm Mary Goodwin from Aurora Photo Center, an Indianapolis-based arts nonprofit that supports visual artists working in photography with a full slate of exhibitions, residencies, workshops, artist talks, and access to creative tools. Megan Gould is in town to install and celebrate her exhibition, Sorry No Pictures, which is organized by Aurora and will open at Tube Factory Art Space on December 1st from 6 until 9 p.m. Sorry No Pictures brings together 20 years of the artist's work, and it explores photography's relationship to technology, as well as the language and issues of sustainability surrounding the medium. Megan is staying at Tube Factory's artist apartment as part of a program for visiting artists working in different genres, staying and working at the Tube Factory campus all year round. Thank you to Tube Factory, Big Car, and Listen Here for this wonderful partnership. Megan Gould is a photographer living and working outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she is a professor of art at the University of New Mexico. She received an MFA from the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and a BA from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her work has been exhibited widely in the United States and internationally, and is included in many private and corporate collections, as well as public collections, including the De Cordova Museum, the New Mexico Museum of Art, Lightwork, and the University of New Mexico Art Museum. In 2022, Gould was named a finalist for the George A. and Eliza Gardner Howard Foundation Fellowship. Her multifaceted practice uses photography, drawing, sculpture, and installation in an open-ended dissection of vision and photographic tools. So welcome to you, Megan Gould. It's wonderful to have you here. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you, Mary. It's amazing to be here. And thank you to everybody who's hosting me here.
Absolutely. We've been talking about trying to get you to Indianapolis for a long, long time. And I'm so glad that it's finally come to fruition. We are going to talk about your latest exhibition, Sorry No Pictures, which is, again, opening at Tube Factory Art Space on December 1st. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But I always like to start these interviews for Create Here with a simple question. You know, how did you get into the arts and specifically into photography? Was there somebody in your family, for example, who sort of led you to photography?
No one at all, particularly. I did have a grandfather who was the family photographer and had a little dark room. And I did inherit his enlarger eventually when I got interested in it. But I did not really know art existed until after my undergraduate time, I would say. I started out as a pre-med major. I followed a very biology-oriented path. My whole family's biologists, until about my second semester of college when I took an anthropology of science class and said, oh, wait, we get to question all this, and started studying cultural anthropology and cultural theory and languages. And then I took an art history class when I studied abroad in France, and all of this just kind of percolated, and I graduated with my very eclectic and fairly useless degree and said, what am I going to do? And I eventually wound up going to a school for writing, for creative nonfiction writing, Salt Institute in Maine. And that is where I was introduced to the darkroom, through a partner working on a project where I was the writer and another person was the photographer, and I met the darkroom. And I fell completely in love and sort of turned away from writing at that point. It was like photographic language just erased written language from my brain completely.
Oh, wow.
And I said, I'm going to keep studying photography. So I began to take night classes in photography and take small jobs in dark rooms. And then I said, I want to commit to this. And I moved to Paris to study photography full on and then back for grad school.
Wow, that is quite a path. I got to rewind just a little bit and ask you. So you started taking night classes in photography and then working in photography and small jobs. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit? Like what kind of jobs were available at that point and what were you doing exactly?
It was the early days of web design. I was doing some web design classes, designing a few websites for whatever, for a university at that time and working. And these classes were at RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design in Providence. And I was working in their darkroom as a darkroom monitor for a few hours and just kind of cobbling it all together while I was soaking up as much photography as I could.
That's great. And you moved to Paris. And where did you study in Paris?
Espace Paris Photographic Institute.
I don't know what that is.
It is a commercially oriented school in Paris, which has a little bit of fine art, a little bit of photojournalism, a little bit of a smorgasbord of photographic approaches with a very robust contemporary art, wandering around Paris looking at art angle also. So we wandered around Paris, we looked at a lot of art, and I had an excellent formal training in studio, in how to approach photography from any number of angles, which has, I think, served me well in the long term, even though I am not a commercial photographer in any way, shape, or form, and that it's very much geared towards that.
Interesting. Well, definitely there's a through line in your work that has to do with technology and how it applies to photography. So like, when did that first start to surface in your work?
Very early. Mm-hmm. Sort of two through lines based in the technology. One is that even in my first few photo one, photo two classes, I had this desire to cut things up, rearrange them, violate the photographic frame in certain ways. It was, I'd say, maybe a gut instinct even in some of my early projects, not very respectful of the piece of paper that I was printing upon and able to think about it in a very sort of plastic way. And then my grad thesis work was all about the written piece as well as the final visual piece was all about the idea of how we hold a camera and why we hold a camera in certain ways and questioning the authority behind our body in relationship to the camera. So early on.
Yeah, and you really investigate every aspect of image making and photography as a medium. You just mentioned like how we hold a camera and why we hold a camera. I mean, that's a pretty fundamental issue about making art, making images with this thing that we think of as photography. And like you just take it back to the beyond the basics, you know, like the physical interaction with the implements of the medium. You have written a book about your thoughts about photography that collects a lot of your philosophy and writing about photography, and I'm going to refer to that now because there's a great story in the book, which is also called Sorry No Pictures, and it was published in 2021. There's a great story about how you talk about that you felt an unease with the camera and holding it and being out in public with it, which is an unusual thing for a photographer, somebody who's interested in photography, to say about this basic piece of equipment that's associated with the medium. So can you talk a little bit about that and what that's meant to your image making?
Yes, and it's something I certainly could not have articulated early on. I found workarounds for my discomfort with the camera, even though I didn't understand that I had it, I think. So, and that was in Paris in particular, one of the assignments that we were given multiple times was to go out in Paris and pretend you are a famous French street photographer and wheeled your camera as some amazing photographers did for decades of French photo history and wait for the decisive moment to happen in front of your lens. And you are always sort of skulking around the streets, waiting, visually waiting. And I was hugely uncomfortable with that and would kind of like hide in corners and just try to avoid being seen with my camera. I think early on, it had something to do for me with wanting to fit in, and to hold a camera was to be seen looking, and to be seen looking was an act of maybe if not tourism, then I was uncomfortable being seen as a viewer in that way. I just wanted to be, you know, scurrying by with my hands in my pockets and blending in, right? So the piece of technology, holding it up to my eye, was this physical interference with the world that I was not comfortable with. And again, I could never have articulated that at the time, but I began making work with a pinhole camera at that time because it was a wooden box and it was not this piece of bulky metal that I was holding up to my face. So I would put the wooden box on the ground, and I was comfortable with that. I was gathering images in a very different way, which has defined much of my career, interestingly, even though I don't think I started doing it for a particularly self-aware reason.
Yeah, cameraless photography and making photographic images in a non-traditional way. That's something that comes up quite a bit throughout the 20 plus years yes. of photography that you've collected. The series that has to do with kind of, it has a title, Don't Open in the Light. And that is another one of these series where you're not working strictly with the camera, with the box. Can you tell us a little bit about that series and how you got to it?
Sure. That series was very much about playing with some of the materials of photographic making. It coincided with a physical move from Maine to New Mexico and me boxing up a lot of ruined photographic material that had traveled with me over the years, and that for some reason I felt I needed to move, even though it was moldy, ruined film or boxes of film that had been leaked on. And I packed it up and I moved it to New Mexico and I unboxed it and I began messing with the film and the paper as raw material. And the title, Don't Open Box in the Light, refers to something I say when I'm teaching all the time, when I have a student who buys a box of black and white paper and I forget the first day of class to tell them not to open it when they buy it. And somebody always does by accident and ruins their box of paper. So a lot of work over the past decade has also involved this the idea of language, particularly language that I use when I'm teaching, and this idea of the language that surrounds and shapes our relationship to photography. So that is language from camera manuals. Again, how do you hold a camera? It's language from software. It's language from hardware. And it's language from boxes of photosensitive paper.
Also language on social media, where
and
images
are
presented and discussed. Yeah, the language surrounding photography is, yes, something that enters your work. You literally have incorporated it into some of your artwork. You have a series that you started in 2018 called Flickr Commentary, where why don't you tell us a little bit about that and how it sort of fits into this idea of like inspecting the medium?
Sure. Well, that also started in the teaching classroom, in that I am interested in watching how we think we need to talk about photographs. And so when I have a lot of undergraduates who in their first classes with me, we have this mysterious art school moment, which we call critique, where we put work up and we're supposed to intelligently speak about it. Mm-hmm. But most folks of a younger generation have only ever seen photographs talked about in a Instagram kind of way. 10 years ago, it was the Flickr kind of way, maybe 15 years ago. And so I began using the Flickr website for photo sharing and bringing it up during a conversation where we talk about what critique should be. I would bring up Flickr and we would look at the comments on Flickr, and together we would dissect those comments. So those comments are like, great photo and, you know, wonderful capture. And they're just inane. They're repetitive. They are redundant. They're not particularly critical.
Or descriptive.
Or descriptive. Yeah. They're just these passive comments that we think we're supposed to say about photos. And that's not what we're doing in critique. Mm-hmm. And so we have this conversation where I allow the students to sort of see what they aren't supposed to do, and we can have a fun conversation about it. So I began harvesting critique, sort of fake critique language from Flickr, and that turned into embroidering those comments onto this photosensitive paper. And there are two of those in the show up right now at Tube Factory.
Yes, they've sort of been memorialized for all time. You know?
Right.
They serve as a reminder not to get, to be intentional about how we look at photography and how we talk about photography. It's important, you know. Visual literacy when it comes to photography is more important today than ever because of just the sheer amount of photography that we live with, that we experience every day. And so I think it is very important, the way that we observe images and talk about them. And like, I love that series because it reminds me of that, how important that is. Yes. Well, we've talked a lot about your work that doesn't involve the camera, but let's talk a little bit about your work that does involve the camera quite a bit. I mean, you absolutely have done many, you know, Through the Lens traditional type series, and this is like another main theme in your work that has to do with workspaces. You know, you have a series that is literally called Workspaces, and you started it in 2010, and it looks at artist studios and the equipment that's there, the way that people use their space to make work, those are sort of what we think of as straightforward photographs. So how does that fit? How does workspaces, how do they fit into your overall art making?
Sure. That body of work, I will note first, was initially commissioned by a magazine in Maine called Maine, the magazine. And they commissioned me to go around the state and look. And each month I would take one photograph of someone's workspace, and an artisan, an artist. And I became deeply invested in that kind of looking at these spaces from that original moment. And I've continued to do it in recent work, specifically looking at photographic darkrooms. Mm-hmm. But I am fascinated by the labor of making, and particularly and the ones I choose myself as opposed to a commission to look at, it's places where we confront tools of practice, and it's sort of the man versus machine question for me. And that's why the current look at the photographic darkroom, it's the way we pick up tools and use them. It's the way we build spaces around tools and around labor. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my own work is using the labor of myself confronting machine in a somewhat absurdist way. And the work with a camera looking at those spaces is a way to just come at it from a different angle, come at the same ideas of labor, art making, tools, self, identity, through all of that from a different angle.
Yes, you mentioned wanting to talk about these spaces and sometimes what I see in your work as the political ramifications of art making, especially when it comes to photography. There is unfortunately, you know, there are ecological issues and always have been when it comes to photography. It's a medium that has a bad reputation vis-a-vis the environment. And you use what you call playful resistance to talk about those issues and the fact that we can't sustain that sort of devil may care attitude towards the environmental ecological impact of photography. And you said, you mentioned specifically absurdist. I wondered, what work of yours were you thinking about when you used the word absurdist?
Oh, a lot of it. the hugely magnified nozzle check. So it's a simple little tool to look at how the ink is coming out of your printer and magnifying that to insane proportions and sort of seeing it as pure form on the wall. Mm-hmm. And then draining the ink out of printers and playing with that ink, all of it is sort of absurd gestures that are, so again, to come back to this idea of playful resistance, that are trying to sort of defy the authority that I think is very photo specific in art making, the authority of the corporations that run, produce all of our, the goods we need to make photographs in the way we think we need to make photographs. Mm-hmm. There's a very narrow set of corporations that run the world for us as photographers. Mm-hmm. And I deeply appreciate them. And obviously we need them. But I also think that we don't subvert the photographic technology in a way that we should sometimes, or we don't push against the boundaries of how we think we're supposed to use it. And that bothers me. And this, I think, comes back to my undergrad obsession with looking at anthropology of science and understanding that you can question how we use tools. You can question how we have learned to receive knowledge and play with it a little bit. So all of that is to say that I think that for me, it's this idea of playful resistance is looking with an eyebrow raised at why we put borders in a certain way on a piece of paper and why that it is scripted that we use 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper in a certain way.
Right.
And how we've received this. But it's not actually a rule. It is just we get lazy with the technology and we forget that we have maybe more agency than we do.
Right. We can question why these things are the way that they are. Absolutely.
Right. We can trim paper to not be 8.5 by 11.
I want to not get too far away from the nozzle check piece. It is just fantastic. And I hope that everybody gets to come see this installation of this piece that's in the exhibition. Sorry, no pictures at Tube. So it is a larger than life. How tall is this one? It's like maybe 5 feet tall?
Maybe 4 feet tall.
So imagine the Epson test pattern, but realized at, 4 feet tall. And you're going to print the entire run of it, right? Is it going to fit on the wall, you think?
It is not going to fit on this wall.
So, okay.
It'll be about two-thirds of it will fit on this wall.
So from a visual standpoint, the piece is just sort of intriguing to begin with, that play with scale. But there's so much more to it that gets to this idea of playful resistance and questioning. So just about everything about this piece is wrong. Epson is not, they've talked to you about this, right? They're not super happy that you're making this piece that mimics their famous test pattern, but there you go. And to make so you paint this test pattern by hand using ink that you have harvested from cartridges, right? Which is also kind of we're told it's a no-no, you're not supposed to do that. Once the cartridge is tells you it's empty, there's nothing in there. But you have cracked these things open and retrieve the ink, save the ink that would have been gone to the landfill, would have just been wasted. And then you collect that ink and use it to paint this test pattern by hand, which is very, it's meticulous work. It takes a long time. And it must be super contemplative. But the end result is just kind of a big question mark about these things that we assume about the technology and the tools of photography. especially, you know, in this case, in the digital realm. Yeah,
correct. It is contemplative to paint it. It's boring. It's tedious, and I find joy in that. Also, it's a 10-second test when you do it on the printer, mm-hmm. and it is to do a full version of it is many days on the wall. I have also made a sewn version of this. I've made a knitted version of this, all using the inks.
Of this meaning the test pattern.
Of the test pattern, mm-hmm. all using the inks to dye whatever material I'm using. And so for me, it's a dialogue with this printer, a dialogue with this printer that guides all contemporary or most contemporary photographic making. It is sort of the master of how we look at printed photographs now, and I am in dialogue with it. And we are in this long conversation where I ask it if it's okay, and it spits out a little tiny paper answer. And then I guess it asks me if I'm okay, and I make this very, very, very long, very long and laborious response in multiple ways.
Yeah, a lot of those same ideas come up in another piece that kind of comes away from the camera and away from the wall, actually. It's called Out of Gamut. And that was from 2016, in which you take a roll of paper. Is it a specific kind of paper?
It is a double-sided matte paper, mm-hmm. because it absorbs the ink.
And you run it through the printer many times, just over and over and over, using the same color, and it produces an entire roll of paper that is one of the pure colors of the ink set, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And this is... it also kind of enters that contemplative space. But can you tell us a little bit more about the reasons behind why you wanted to produce Out of Gamut?
Partly I was, and continue to be, again, obsessed with this idea of how the technology controls us versus we control the technology. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in the fact that you aren't supposed to reload something through the printer and mm-hmm. print on it again, unlike in the dark room, it is hard to make a double exposure, and the technology does not want us to use it in different ways. So it began as an act of frustration in trying to line several pieces up on one piece of paper, and I couldn't do it. The software wouldn't allow me, so I began to play with what it would allow me to do, mm-hmm. and to push against its rules and to ask it to create something that is not reproducible for something that from a machine that is made to only make reproducible objects. So I tried to again, I'll use the word subvert, but push at what it would allow me to do and run the same piece of paper over and over and over through with the same exact parameters, but starting from a slightly different point and allowing my hand again to sort of insist on the printer messing up. And so it became this act of pushing the button and playing with pushing the button, and so many other things were sort of swirled around into that piece, including mothering. I had a young mm-hmm. baby at that time, and it was this act of I could hear the printer stop and I could run back to the room and press print again and move the paper a little bit. So it became also this way to fit making into my domestic reality mm-hmm. and allow the printer to become an actor in my domestic reality in this interesting way in my household. So it was all these things kind of swirled into one, and it became these long, 100-foot-long rolls of paper for each of them that represents each of the Epson color set inks.
Yeah, they are also quite beautiful objects when you get done. You can feel the amount of time and energy and thought that's been invested in them. I'm going to just continue to use the filter of the camera as a discussion point for your work. And we've talked a lot about work that is photographic, talks about photography, but doesn't actually use a camera. But there is a series that you've done that kind of goes in the opposite direction and just hyper focuses on the camera and specifically the iconography of particular cameras and viewfinders. You have utilized those specific aspects of cameras to talk further about the medium and make some, quite frankly, stunning images, especially the viewfinders. Those become abstract, almost like little tiny little planets, little gems. Love that work. We are featuring one of those in your exhibition at Tube Factory. Yes, could you tell us a little bit about how, let's just talk about the viewfinders. How does the viewfinders series fit into your overall discussion of the technology of photography?
Sure. Again, control and language of control and language of photographic pointing towards things, the ways that we are supposed to look at, frame, and shape an image. And over the decades of the 20th century in particular, the ways that cameras shifted in size and in focusing mechanisms, the specifics of the cameras changed enormously over that century. But all the while, you have these manufacturers trying to help people make the photographs they wanted to make. And that help often looks like obscure markings. It looks like numbers. It has all these various ways that it is shaping what you are seeing as you make a picture, even though you don't see it in the final picture. And I was sort of very interested in that level of supportive help that you are getting as you make a picture. So I began to just concentrate on that and to remove what's happening beyond the viewfinder and just allow us to stare at a viewfinder. So I just sort of take the cameras apart to make the viewfinder moments, to honor the viewfinder moments and elevate them. And then that, a decade later, turned into me looking at other language specific to the camera capture, which would be the icons you spoke about. And that, again, looking at how the camera is telling us how we are supposed to make pictures. So whether it's something in the center of the frame or with the icons work, how we're supposed to categorize vision. So in that case, it is on most single lens reflex cameras, there are some sort of indication of the scenes you might be looking at. So you might be looking at faraway mountains, the landscape mode. You might be looking at sports photography, which is usually a runner's lunge to identify the correct settings for speedy photography. And for portrait mode, it's almost always a woman's face or a woman's head. And it is oddly gendered as such, as a woman. And I've became very interested in that and began to make this loosely autobiographical work based in these icons that I harvested. I keep using the word harvested. That I harvested from cameras and reworked into this sort of vast story.
Autobiographical story.
Loosely autobiographical.
Yes, the runner's lunge. You are, in fact, a runner yourself. That fits nicely into that narrative. And you created three large-scale pieces using this iconography from different cameras. And you cyanotype on muslin to create sort of a pattern or a collection of these icons from different cameras that also touch on things that are relevant to your life. That's a wonderful piece that's included in your exhibition here at Tube Factory that's opening on Friday. Definitely, if you're in the area, come to see that for sure. Well, Megan, you this is 20 years of your work, and you know you are a writer, you're a philosopher, you're a teacher, you're an educator, you're a mother. You've lived all these many lives at once, and you had the courage to sit down in 2020 and 2021 and like write it down and create this amazing book called Sorry, No Pictures, which just brings all the many threads of your thought about the medium and your life in art together. And it's incredible. Every page is a revelation. And I love your voice. You know, we've talked a lot about language today, but your humor and your voice is so concrete, so present in the writing that you do in Sorry No Pictures. And then with each page has an image and then an anecdote or a narrative or some theme that you want to develop about photography. And it's just wonderfully constructed book that inspired me to I've read it several times, and I thought, wow, the only way that this could be improved as a statement about photography in your life is maybe to play with the scale, you know, to an exhibition immediately sprang to mind to provide the opportunity to see the actual visual pieces that are in the book in conjunction with your work, but to see the work at scale. And that thus was born the idea of the exhibition that is happening here in a couple of days. But it's been interesting, you know, trying to realize an exhibition that is in some ways, I mean, of course, it's based on your life's work, but it was very much sprang from this book. And we talked about, like, how do you stage a book in space, you know, books in space. It's been an interesting challenge, you know. And we decided, we went back and forth about different ways, you know, how much weight to give the text in the gallery space versus the visual work. And we've gone a couple of ways thinking about integrating QR codes and things online in terms of the text. But ultimately, we decided to let the visual work really, I think, have the upper hand in this exhibition, and to really preserve the physical relationship with the book. You know, like, we're going to have the book in the gallery for viewers to read along as they will with each one of the visual pieces. And then we have cues about which page to read. And it's just a really, I think it's a very elegant way to bring your book and the ideas that you express in your book to life on the gallery wall. And your writing is so fantastic. I was worried that, you know, that your words are so beautiful that they might steal some of the beauty of the visual pieces. But I think we found a good balance. Yeah. Yeah.
I think so, too. I'm excited for people to be able to have that intimate moment with the book, with the book as an object, while at the same time experiencing the work.
Absolutely.
I think it's a good solution.
Obviously, I'm a fan of the book, but I'm not the only one. You are in the third printing of this book, which is amazing. You know, it's self-published, and to be on a third printing of that book, it's, you know, congratulations for that. I think it is an instant classic myself, and we're going to be reading this book in for a long time to come. But yes.
Well, can I just say thank you to Mary for the vision of putting this into an exhibition? I never envisioned it that way. And the joy I have found in putting together the 20 years of practice based in the choices I made for the book and what I was talking about in the book has been illuminating, and it's absolutely thrilling to put it on the walls like that.
Yes, it has been just a joy and very exciting at every phase. But yes, we have this exhibition that's coming up, but you are continuing to make new work constantly. I know that we talked about you even making some images here in Indianapolis while you were here. Right now, this goes back to something else that you mentioned briefly before, that you are working on documenting dark rooms, and this is sort of a subset of the Workspaces series that you started in 2010. You know, dark rooms. Aurora Photo Center has been in the process of opening up a small one-user dark room. And so, like, I feel like dark rooms are very much present in my life, but they are somewhat of a growing rarity these days. A lot of people are just deciding that they want to transition strictly to digital. And so it's getting harder and harder to find them. And was that like part of your motivation for wanting to document them?
Absolutely. Partly it was a realization when I began inquiring about dark rooms, a realization that there were many fewer than I expected. When I left photo school 20 years ago, building a dark room in a closet was a rite of passage. Mm-hmm. I feel like most people still made some sort of scrappy dark room in their living situation. If they were obsessed with photography, it was just what you did. Mm-hmm. And now we still teach darkroom photography, and I ask my students what they're going to do when they graduate, and most of them shrug and they don't know how they're going to do it, and they will not. Most is the answer for most of them. They will work digitally, and that's fine. For me, it's not a either or, and it's not a prioritization of one way of working photographically over another, but there is a barrier to entry, I think, that is very difficult for darkroom. And then, as Absolutely. You mentioned earlier, so there's this economic barrier to entry now. It's very expensive to do. But also there is an environmental barrier that I think we don't talk about enough and that we should talk about. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not for me. I don't see the world in absolutes, and I think it's complicated. But I do think that we have to be very careful honoring darkroom photography, and we have to be attentive to the fact that it's not environmentally friendly. And in New Mexico, I often wonder how much we can keep running the water that we need to wash mm-hmm. a print that a student might never look at again. So it becomes a really complicated problem. All of this to say is I began reaching out and finding just to know how many darkrooms were out there, and I was a little shocked at how few I found that are actively used. So I began to photograph them as something of an archive of these spaces that have shaped much of photography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't wait to see that particular series. You have an exhibition of that work that's coming up. Is it later this year?
It is up now at the Griffin Museum of Photography in Boston.
Okay. And it's called Darkrooms?
It is a two-person show with Christopher Rauschenberg about artists' studio spaces, and the darkrooms are half of that.
Definitely, if you're in the Boston area, check that out for sure. Getting back to things that you are doing concurrent with this exhibition, you are also giving a demo about the anthotype process while you're here in Indianapolis. And I think your reasons for working with anthotype are going to touch on a lot of the same themes that we've talked about in this interview, and especially with sustainability, right?
I mean, absolutely.
The anthotype process uses plant-based materials, so it is, in theory, more sustainable than traditional photographic darkroom photography. Or certainly digital photography.
Correct. I began doing that as a question for myself, which would be what might photography after the apocalypse look like if we didn't have corporate control over image making at the collapse of capitalism and the corporations that control the technologies we use to make photographs, what photosensitive joy could we still experience? And the easiest and obvious and crudest answer is this anthotype, which is plant-based emulsion that coats paper, and you plop something on that paper and the sun bleaches everything around what is covering the paper, and voila, you have a very crude photograph. And they're slow and they're tedious and they're very colorful and they're pure, slow photographic joy.
Absolutely. And that's a process that has been around since the beginning of photography, right?
Yes, it has absolutely been around and much ignored over the course of photographic history. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of artists experimenting with it now. I think a lot of folks like myself during the pandemic shutdown, lockdown times were working with how you can teach photography in that context from home. And that was a really beautiful and elegant way to do so. And that's how I got back into it.
Yes, I love this, your vision for a post-corporate photography that involves the kitchen sink, so to speak, you know, things that you can find around your house. And also goes back to the very beginning of where photography started. That's sort of a really elegant thought. Well, Megan Gold, I want to thank you so much for your time here and for this conversation. Really looking forward to your opening on Friday, December 1st from 6 until 9. Sorry, no pictures. And I want to thank the folks at Listen Here for their time, especially Sean Jones. And this is the latest episode of Create Here. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye.